Welcome to Not So Different, a podcast from the Center for Biosimilars. I'm your host, Senior Editor Kelly Davio. In its semi-annual drug pricing forecast, healthcare performance company Vizient said that biosimilars will be a key part of combating rising spending on drugs among its membership. Vizient's membership currently spends about $67 billion on drugs annually, and with a projected 4% drug price inflation, these members are expected to spend another $3 billion annually. That's before even considering cost increases for new drugs or volume changes. This week on the podcast, we're speaking with Stephen Lucio, Associate Vice President of Clinical Solutions and Pharmacy Program Development at Vizient. He explained how biosimilars can be part of the solution to the problem of rising drug costs. Stephen, thank you so much for joining us for this episode of Not So Different.
Oh, thank you so much. Really appreciate the opportunity to speak on this extremely important topic.
So, Stephen, the drug pricing forecast from Vizient suggested that this could be the summer of biosimilars. And certainly we've seen some big movement lately with the launch of the first two anti-cancer products. What are we seeing so far in terms of uptake of those biosimilars and in terms of the appetite for them in the market? Or is it just too soon to tell?
Great question. And first of all, let me thank you for reviewing the information that is within our drug price forecast. It's definitely a labor of love to assemble that information for our membership and for the larger audience. And so we really appreciate the opportunity to expand on that subject. I think you are correct with the too soon to tell designation. As we relate in our forecast, you know, the three biologics where biosimilar competition has become available, like you say, or hopefully will soon be launched, meaning rituximab, bevacizumab, and trastuzumab, that presently accounts for over $10 billion in annual spend across the U.S. healthcare environment. And so because of that, the appetite for competition remains large because of that acquisition cost, but also the channel by which these drugs are distributed tends to be more expensive for the health system provider. So yes, the interest is very high, but given the relative newness of being within this landscape, I think we're still much within the too soon to tell situation. But it's something we are definitely watching very closely to understand what the market is doing and how these new launches are impacting our membership.
You mentioned biosimilar rituximab, and while of course we do have a couple of approved biosimilars, we don't have one commercially available yet. When we do have a biosimilar rituximab available, do you anticipate there being any problems with the skinny label? Because of course both of the approved products do not carry all of the indications of the reference.
No, great question. And it is important to consider not only the label, but also the formulation as it relates to rituximab. So first of all, we do expect the use of this product to be very high, again, given the cost. But there are these two considerations. One is the label difference. Now, the good thing is that for some of the primary indications, there actually is coverage, you know, for those circumstances. Also, there was a little bit of variety in the clinical trials that were conducted to support the various rituximab products that does help fill in, I think, some of the gaps that might otherwise provide caution for oncologists and hematologists in the use of this agent. So I think there are some considerations, but there are at least clinical data to help people through that. And obviously, we're trying to help our members educate their physicians on the manner in which biosimilarity is determined, so that way those types of elements can be mitigated. And that way physicians understand it's not a function of the performance of the product, why they don't have those indications. It relates to patents and protection and exclusivities that have not yet expired. So that's one thing that definitely pharmacists have to be cognizant of, so that way they can mitigate. The other element that's also important for this product and also the trastuzumab product is the fact that innovation for a molecule doesn't cease necessarily when that product loses exclusivity. And what we're talking about is the circumstance where branded companies will continue to develop and create additional formulations or other enhancements to a molecule to extend the life cycle of their franchise. And so here's a circumstance where the impact of biosimilar competition is going to be impacted because the originator has developed, in this case, a subcutaneous formulation. So the biosimilars have to compete not only against the initial branded reference counterpart, but also against these modified formulations where there's some type of efficiency or a patient convenience consideration. As you know, we've seen this manifest itself with the on-body formulation of pegfilgrastim that has certainly impacted the uptake of the biosimilar competitors in that market. And we expect that this is going to also be a circumstance there with rituximab and as I alluded to, trastuzumab. So given the introduction and what we've seen in terms of the increased use of the subcutaneous formulations, the extent of the market share that biosimilars can be expected to capture is going to be impacted. And so that is important for, again, people looking at this market to understand, to discern exactly where the subcutaneous usage is most appropriate, but also where you can utilize the injectable, you know, infused formulation, because you don't need that subcutaneous product in every patient circumstance. So it does create additional due diligence that the providers, the pharmacists must conduct, and then also the biosimilar providers and manufacturers must make sure that their combined value takes into account this additional market factor.
So if we take a step back and kind of look at the biosimilars market as a whole in the United States, it would probably be fair to say that a lot of stakeholders have been disappointed with how the market for inflammatory disease biosimilars has shaped up in the U.S. in the last few years. Are there some lessons learned from the inflammatory disease space that can be applied now to the anti-cancer products that are emerging so that we don't make some of the same mistakes?
I think it is very correct to say that we would have liked to have seen a much greater degree of uptake by this point in time, but similarly, we should not be surprised by the slow rate of success. As you know, and as the market understands, the generic landscape did not materialize rapidly. It took a lot of effort. And given the complexity and really the interrelatedness of the current pharmacy supply chain, and that includes the specialization of drug development, the push and pull we've seen between providers and payers to control medication use, we really truly had no reason to expect that the adoption of biosimilars would be easy. What I tell members and other audiences is that in spite of the challenges we have faced, we cannot by any measure abandon our efforts. As we have seen, again, we're talking about a $10 billion spend that is opening up to competition with these three biologic products. Where we see both within our clinical literature and the news every day, the hardship presented by the increasing cost of medications, the multitude of proposals that exist to try and deal with that expense. Biosimilars are not going to resolve every challenge we face, but they are a critical avenue to combat this expense. And so we must continue to drive towards their adoption and support the increasing, you know, span of their influence within the market. While they are more difficult, while biosimilars are more difficult to implement than generic products, the opportunity obviously is greater. And that's important not only from the standpoint of providers, health systems, but also from patients. And we have to keep that in mind. And so one of the things that we tell our audiences is first that they have to have an integrated approach for success. So we obviously look to pharmacy to lead these discussions, but you're not going to be successful on your own without the help, obviously, of the physicians, but even more so, I think, the relationships with your billing and finance departments, given the influence that these products have on reimbursement implications within your organizations. And so it's really that integrated approach, making sure there's the clinical understanding, but also the alignment with the other strategic financial related endeavors that you're working on. The other thing that is extremely important to remember, and this is one way, again, to help, I believe, drive further acceptance of biosimilars, and that is, what is the end result and impact for patients? You will definitely get greater tolerance for changes and for considerations of your prescriber colleagues if you can articulate to them and they can see that this is a direct benefit to the patient population. And so having that integrated approach and also being able to articulate the opportunity for the patient populations, I think those are two things that we have seen given the experience we've had thus far with other biosimilars that hopefully will translate to improved use within the oncology landscape.
In the drug pricing forecast, Vizient mentions that it's put together a task force around biosimilars to help members evaluate the oncology biosimilars as soon as they launch. Can you tell us a bit more about the task force?
Sure. Vizient is a large organization, and we provide many solutions to our members in terms of our consulting, our analytics, our member support, networking, and obviously our sourcing capabilities. And so there's has been, since the advent of biosimilars, efforts in all of those areas to provide support for members. But what we've identified, given the experience that we've seen, is that for something as critical as this topic, we need to have as integrated of a solution as possible. And so that's why we put this task force together that comprises, you know, people from all those different areas to make sure that we had this seamless approach to the tools, the reports, the evidence-based clinical resources that we provide to help members and assist them with their evaluation of biosimilars and hopefully support improved implementation of these products. So this group has been working to develop materials that extend beyond the baseline sourcing opportunities to provide that additional insight needed to make sure that biosimilar adoption occurs in as appropriate a fashion and as a timely a fashion as possible. And so the materials we have developed, they're on our website for our members, and they're also available to our consulting colleagues, to all the people that are working hand in hand with our members to help them in this endeavor. So the, as I mentioned, you know, one of the most critical things we've learned from the biosimilar experience we've had thus far is having that integrated approach in terms of what the members should be doing. And so we are similarly developing those integrated approaches in terms of the way internally we support and engage our members around this most critical topic.
You're also working on a financial evaluation tool so that your members can assess the impact of different biosimilar strategies. How do you anticipate that that tool will work?
Absolutely, and something obviously that has made this transition with biosimilars more complicated than what we have traditionally experienced with inpatient generic drugs is the fact that, you know, value is not just a function of cost and minimizing cost, but it is a consideration also that has to take into account the impact on revenue opportunities, the overall financial performance, reimbursement, and as we spoke about earlier, the out-of-pocket expense for patients. So we have done a lot, obviously, in terms of developing clinical resources, but we have extended and expanded the scope of our analytic tools so that way members can assess the financial impact that is specific for their organizations, because as we've seen, payers develop many different strategies, and so the reimbursement landscape for each and every member is going to be unique. So to address that, we've developed these tools, these financial evaluation methodologies, so that way members can assess their specific level of reimbursement from a private payer circumstance, as well as Medicare and Medicaid, to construct models that are appropriate for them. And so that way they can make the determination that is most appropriate. And so we have these tools that either members can utilize on their own, or in some circumstances, if they don't have the complement of staffing or the expertise that is required, our consulting team, our analytics team, can also take these and again develop that personalized approach so that way members can again can assess in the most accurate manner possible what the advent of biosimilars would mean for them and obviously for their patient populations. And as the market continues to expand and diversify with more agents, we'll be revising our tools to reflect the impact of those additional products and what they mean for pricing and reimbursement.
Well, lastly, Stephen, is there anything that you would like to add to this discussion?
I think it is incredibly important that we not give up on biosimilars, even though it has been an ongoing challenge and it is taking a lot of time. One of the things that I always articulate to the membership is that there are some elements of the biosimilar experience that are unique to biosimilars, including the way in which they are regulated and approved by FDA, and developing familiarity with their labeling and their naming and trying to address interchangeability. But there's other elements of our environment that are just a function of the healthcare landscape and are not the fault of biosimilars. So again, the high cost, the complexity of supply, the way in which, again, we see this interaction between providers and payers trying to discern who is best able to control costs. And those, again, are not unique to biosimilars. That impacts all of the different agents that we presently use. And so rather than exhausting ourselves just on the concept of biosimilarity, we need to look at biosimilars in a broader context. And so the things that we can learn through our experience of biosimilars help and inform our strategies towards drugs in total, and the way in which we look at regulation, the way in which we look at the supply to ensure that we have the best manufacturing possible, and really getting at that conundrum of what should medications cost, given the cost of drug discovery, of regulation, of manufacturing, of marketing, and biosimilars help us do that. And so when you look at this methodology, again, look at it as something above and beyond biosimilars that, yes, they're important in and of themselves, but they help us understand the bigger picture and hopefully educate our physician and prescriber colleagues, as well as the patients that we serve, so that way they can understand, you know, why the market is as such and why, you know, it's so important for us to continue to drive for solutions that help us address this cost equation.
Well, Stephen, thank you so much for joining us for this episode of Not So Different and for sharing your perspective with us.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Not So Different. To read more about Vizient's drug pricing forecast, visit our show notes. Remember, if you like the podcast, please take a moment to rate us at iTunes. Until next time, find us at centerforbiosimilars.com.